Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It is certainly great to be back on the air, as always, and hard to believe that we are almost near the end of April. I don't know where all the time has gone, but as I've said before, and I can say here again, when you're having fun and when you're keeping busy, the time itself just flies by very quick. Unfortunately, as we get older, we don't always get to control just how quickly time itself moves, but it is up to us to be able to enjoy every minute that we have and also to be able to make the most of the time that we have, given that time itself should not be taken for granted. I must say that when I was on the air last time, I was pleased to find out just a couple of days ago after the last time I was on the air to see how many more results, not just from the series that we've been doing, but for those of you who are new to my podcasts in general, thank you for taking an interest. I'm sure that many of you have found whom are new to my podcasts are have learned an abundant amount of information, regardless of the topic, on a particular event or person that you probably didn't know before. So that, to me, is what makes history well worth learning about. Just when we think we've learned everything there is to learn about a particular event or person, we're always finding something new. And that should help us constantly move forward in the right direction. Yes, history, as valuable as it can be, yes, there are things about history that aren't always pleasant. But regardless of the perspective, it is up to us to learn as much as there is possible so that we do have a better understanding and that we don't, as they say, you know, we certainly don't want history to repeat itself. So bottom line is we need to continue to learn everything there is about the past, no matter when it took place, so that we can get a better understanding of it in the present day time and then move forward in the future so that we know that what we have learned is not only relevant, but make sure that it that whatever happened in the past that wasn't good does not repeat itself in the future. I think that's something that we all need to be reminded of no matter where we live in the world. But I will say this, I do have some breaking news to report, and it's not from a television station, folks. I'm not, but of course, many of you probably could think of me as someone who is my own news reporter or my own journalist. I didn't go to journalism school, but I will admit there was a time when I didn't like writing, but I have certainly embraced writing a lot more over time. I've come to realize that writing itself is one of those things that just doesn't happen overnight in terms of success. I think to be very good at writing, you have to be very mature about it, and you have to grow with it. It is a work of art unto itself. But anyways, the breaking news that I will report is that in this next podcast segment episode of Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool, Frederick is going to be embarking, Frederick Tudor, I should say, is going to be embarking on something even more grand than what he has already done. I mean, yes, he's already proven to the naysayers, even those from within the inner circle, the Brahmins, the wealthy Bostonians, he's already proven to them that ice can be shipped from a New England region that's, you know, cooler, or I should say colder than, say, places like Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia, from a domestic standpoint. But he has been able to prove so far to the naysayers out there that, hey, ice can be shipped as long as it's stored safely and how do we call it? Loaded properly. It can be sent from Massachusetts down south to Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, New Orleans, Louisiana. It can also be sent to places like in the West Indies. We have learned that he has had success in Martinique. He's had success in Havana, Cuba. But the big news here, folks, is that Frederick Tudor is going to be going to India. He himself isn't going to India, but he's going to be sending shipments of ice to India. That's the breaking news, and that's what we're going to learn about here. We're going to learn about a radical journey that's going to be more than just a couple of weeks' time or a month at most. We're going to be talking anywhere from 7 weeks and greater. I mean, 7 weeks at minimum, 10 weeks and over at max. But we're going to be talking about journeys that have never been seen before. And we're going to be talking about transporting ice 16,000 miles across the ocean from one hemisphere to another. So let's get the show on the road while we've got the time. It's six pages, folks, and we can do it. So let's get the show on the road with our first leadoff question to for this podcast segment episode of Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade. So here we go. By the early 1830s, had Frederick Tudor himself become a well-known figure in Boston? Yes. Given he had become a respectable merchant, whom contributed to Boston's economic success per a trade practice which nobody else but himself saw as relevant just a couple of years before. Remember, folks, the Brahmins and others in general, they've scoffed at this. They've scoffed at this idea that the thought of putting cargo on a vessel that could show signs of melting while being loaded as a wasteful endeavor. Who's to say by the time the ice gets to its final destination that any of it will remain intact? Well, Frederick has proven many people from different ranks of society, he's proven them wrong. And now they're taking this seriously. Maybe not everybody's going along, but there are enough people in the community now who are realizing that, hey, this guy wasn't joking all along. He was serious. I mean, he has made all kinds of sacrifices to ensure that this endeavor is in fact a true life success. He has proven that he has taken a commodity that we have taken for granted in our own backyards during the winter time, where the lakes and the ponds and the rivers freeze, and come springtime, we don't do anything about it. We just let it watch and melt. Frederick has proven differently, and we learned from the previous episode about Nathaniel Wyeth's horse plow invention, where he ultimately got a patent on it from the year 1829. Where it was a two-man team where one man was in the front and one man was in the back assisting the horse and the plow as the horse, per the machine, was able to cut regular straight lines without anything being irregular, to where the ice blocks came out clear, to where it was basically a cost-cutting method. Very revolutionary, to say the least. The early 1830s saw the ice trade as a fully established business in Boston. Frederick wasn't the only shipper of ice, but many saw him as the lead authority figure behind all the ins and outs to the trade, or I should say the skills behind the trade. If I wasn't in this business, and if I was living during this time and I was living in New England, I would consider Frederick Tudor to be the utmost lead authority figure behind everything there was to this trade. Well, in April of 1833, a fellow named Samuel Austin, who was a Boston merchant, approached Frederick Tudor by asking if he was interested in pursuing a joint venture. Okay, a joint venture, a two-man team, both men are going to seek getting equal profits on an investment, on an endeavor. Well, did Boston, Massachusetts already have an established trade partnership with India? What do you all think? The answer is yes. But if I'm not mistaken, doesn't Boston, most notably Boston, rely on exports coming into the wharves or into the ports? Yes, the Port of Boston is far more dependent upon, imports, correct me. They're more dependent upon all goods being brought into them versus sending stuff out. We learned early on that Boston did not have access to such common luxury, well, I don't know if I'd say luxuries, but daily essential natural resources like iron and coal to ship out. When goods are coming into Boston, the merchants not only are buying them, but they are selling them to people within the greater community as a means of making extra profits. So if Boston does have a fully established, if they have a fully established trade partnership with India, what exactly are the ships from the Port of Boston shipping out en route to India? Well, the ships departing from Boston, folks, are loaded only with ballast. I know I've mentioned about ballast before. That's heavy material that gets placed in lower compartments of a vessel for stability purposes, going to faraway destinations. Like faraway destinations to me, like the Far East, being India. But the ballast is heavy material. It can be, it doesn't have to be confined to just one thing in terms of heavy material. But when I think of resources that are described as heavy material, I think of gravel, sand, iron, lead, and most importantly, rocks. We should be reminded, folks, that that New Englanders, and probably in states elsewhere, but I do know that that rocks were very common. Using rocks was a common practice for ballast purposes weight. In other words, heavy material for stability purposes. Without rocks and all that, I don't know how ships going as far away to destinations like the Far East might even be able to stay afloat and to be able to maintain buoyancy. Because think about it, you know, you're going from one body of water to another, say the Atlantic Ocean, eventually all the way to the Indian Ocean. You know, different currents, different setup. But the bottom line is you need to have enough ballast to stay afloat regardless of where you're going. Now, as for Samuel Austin, yes, he is not directly involved with the ice trade, but he firmly believed that if Frederick pulled off an incredible feat behind shipping ice cargoes to the ports of Bombay, Madras, and Calcutta, that shipping itself would grow, or I should say expand greatly, into the East Indies. Of course, we think of the West Indies, we got the Caribbean islands. In the East Indies, it's Borneo, Java, Sumatra. When I think of Sumatra, I think of the of that terrible incident that happened nearly 20 years ago, that horrific tsunami that came through through the Indian Ocean and devastated smaller nations, and Sumatra was one of them. Hard to believe that was 20 years ago. It was just a couple of days after Christmas of 04. So, you know, most people say, oh, 20 years ago wasn't a long time, but sometimes it does seem like that. So Frederick Tudor is very supportive behind Samuel Austin's proposal to ship ice directly to India. So the two of them, along with a third partner named William Rogers, all agreed to have one-third interest, or I should say stake, in this partnership. So if you have one-third interest, each man gets 33% of the profits. Now, they agreed that Calcutta would be the head port of all business affairs. Come May 12th, 1833, the brig Tuscany sailed out of Boston with William Rogers, the agent, on board. Now, what we're going to get into here next, folks, is it's very important because it's one thing to send out a crew on the on a vessel or on a brig, I should say. You want to have a crew that's seasoned. You want to have a crew that's experienced. You want to have a crew that is veteran. In other words, you want to have a crew that's been together maybe for 3 to 5 years. That doesn't seem like the longest time. But we also have to remember, too, folks, when young men are going out to sea at this time, we're not talking 20-year-olds. We're talking about young men just over the age of 10. So the crew that is boarding the brig Tuscany, all of them were elite. They were native boys whom went to sea around the age of 13. They started going to sea around age 13. Remember, folks, as I've said before, and I could say here again, it's not just from this podcast like book topic series we're doing, but it's been from other ones that when children made it to the age of 10 in colonial times and even after the colonial era in America, they were considered to be adults. They had pretty much built up a strong immune system if they had made it past the age of 10. They had technically they had become an adult. For one, you know, life expectancy is not high, but two, making it past the age of 10, the child, him or herself, is going in the right direction. So these young boys, or we could say young men, are going to sea around age 13, and they are learning their crafts from young aged captains whom are not even 30 years old, folks. Many of these young age captains are in their early to mid-20s. So it just goes to show you that many of these young boys whom are starting out as rookie sailors or past rookie sailors, some could be starting at age 13. Others are just over the age of 13. But regardless, they've been a team for some time, and they know what they're doing. This group could be considered like SEAL Team 6 of the Navy. They could be like the equivalent to the Army, the Green Berets of the Army. This crew could be a good example of the few and the proud. They are like survival of the fittest. Now, were any records found regarding Tuscany's voyage to Calcutta? Unfortunately, folks, there are no records that have ever been found regarding Tuscany's voyage to Calcutta. However, there was a captain who went by the last name of Littlefield, Captain Littlefield, who was Tuscany's captain. He never left a journal or an official account behind the voyage itself. There could have been lots of personal reasons why a journal nor an official account was ever left behind. But what we do need to do here is try to pretend that we are in Captain Littlefield and his crew's shoes going aboard on this voyage, 16,000 miles across the ocean, from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Indian Ocean. It's very likely that Captain Littlefield and his crew were under intense orders. Okay, what kind of intense orders do you think that Captain Littlefield and the crew were under? Well, for one, they were one intense order that they were advised not to do was to not open the hatches. Okay, if you open the hatches, what's going to happen? The ice itself could be exposed to various things, such as rough waves coming over the ship's deck, the water making its way into the hatches, and that salt water could ultimately speed up the ice cargoes in the hatches. It could speed up the ice. It could speed up its melt time, or its melting per hour. In other words, maybe some ice might melt by the time it gets to Calcutta. But the bottom line is you want more ice intact versus ice that melts in order to, you know, be able to make a good profit. So we do know, obviously, that Captain Littlefield and his crew would have, one intense order they would have been under would have been to have not opened the hatches. but most importantly, make sure that the ice itself was sealed in and protected from seawater. Failure to keep ice sealed in would result in ice dissolving away much faster. Okay, if Captain Littlefield and his crew did have direct contact with the ice itself, what would it have involved? It would have involved constant pumping out of melt water. In other words, if there is a presence of melt water, you've got to do whatever it takes to pump out that melt water so that it doesn't interfere with all the ice that is still intact. Any melt water that gets in the way of ice that's currently intact has the means of reducing the thickness of the ice and also greater means of melting ice at a faster rate. Besides having, and yes, folks, well, let me ask you this. Is it fair to say that that the crew on board the Tuscany might have had actual livestock on this ship? Yes. Now, do you think it's fair to say that the crew on board Tuscany is going to have to find some other means of getting food? Remember, folks, we don't have, you know, modern day refrigerators on board these ships, so therefore we don't have any means whatsoever of preserving frozen foods like frozen lasagnas, frozen meat to for like ground sausage. Now, if there are some foods that have been preserved, most likely it's going to be your salted pork or chipped beef. You might have some hardtack on there. You might have some vegetables that have been able to be preserved by means of salt or through pickling. But besides having livestock on board Tuscany, what else would the crew itself have performed in terms of gathering food? They would have fished in the southern seas for bonito, B-O-N-I-T-O, bonito. What is bonito? It's a medium-sized ray-finned predatory fish that's part of the tuna and mackerel family. The crew would have also fished for various shark species. So yes, folks, they had to be very creative, given that, well, yes, you may have your salted pork and your salted beef. Even those foods don't last forever. I mean, yes, you can salt them all you want, but depending on the region that you're in, when you get into a different region, like, say, the southern seas, and when you get closer to the Indian Ocean, as temperatures fluctuate, whatever you have preserved may not last as long as it did per the other region that you were traveling in and so forth. Just one of a handful of factors to have to factor in. Whenever the Tuscany crew spotted other ships passing in the opposite direction, and here's a form of communication that was relied upon, because remember, you weren't guaranteed to see a ship passing in the opposite direction per the hour or every other hour. You might see a ship passing, say, early in the afternoon, but you might not see another ship pass for another 3 to 4 hours. So whenever the Tuscany crew spotted ships passing in the opposite direction, they used what was called a semaphore, and that's spelled S-E-M-A-P-H-O-R-E. I didn't know anything about a semaphore until reading this book, but a semaphore is a system of transmitting messages by holding the arms or two flags or two poles per specific positions based on alphabetic codes. It might be fair to say that a semaphore was an earlier version of what we knew as Morse code that was widely used. And believe it or not, folks, Morse code, I believe, was widely used up until the late 20th century. So using a semaphore was the earliest version of Morse code, especially if involving the transmitting of messages by holding the arms of two flags or poles per specific positions based on the codes that are being presented. So that's a very unique way of trying to gather some intelligence based upon what is being relayed or what you're trying to relay back to the opposing ship. So the semaphore helped relay messages, providing relevant information for those waiting back home. Now, it wouldn't be until early 1834, and I'll mention this again here in a little while, but it won't be until early 1834, which would mark the time where Frederick Tudor himself would first officially hear of the end outcome to Calcutta, India. So this ship left out of Boston on May 12th of 1833. So if Frederick's not going to find out until early 1834, at best, you know, he's looking at maybe 8 or 9 months. That's a long time. A lot of wondering, hey, you know, what if this does make it? But what if it didn't? If it doesn't make it, how much money do I stand to lose? You know, it's not like there's a telephone where he could just pick up the phone and say, hey, how are things going on this voyage? Or I need to make an international call. I need to find out the status of where the ship is on the ocean. We just don't have that kind of technology at that time. What's unique about September 6th, 1833? The newspaper known as the Calcutta Courier confirmed a vessel Tuscany having officially arrived into the Ganges River Delta region with a full shipload of ice. Calcutta Courier, along with India Gazette, the rival newspaper, early on, folks, when they learned of this news, they, you know, reporters from each newspaper company each thought at first that the ice cargo shipments were a prank. And I could see probably why they would have thought this was a prank because, you know, think about it. How in the world could anyone ship a cargo that not only stood the chance of getting melted while loaded from the origin, only to wonder, will it even last the entire way to the end destination? What's going on here? Well, it turns out that the reporters from both of these newspaper companies would soon learn, or I should say they soon learned of the successes from that had occurred elsewhere in the world, most notably in the West Indies, as well as in various places south of New England in the United States. So they reporters from both of these newspaper companies did learn from other sources in India, high-level sources, about the success elsewhere. So now they're probably taking a nice sigh of relief and realizing that, well, maybe what we've been told is no longer a prank. It's the real deal. All right, well, what are some interesting facts about Calcutta, India? Of course, I can tell you this much. When I think of Calcutta, India, she's been deceased since the late 1990s, but Mother Teresa was her name. She did a lot of charitable work for those in Calcutta, India, whom were not as fortunate. In other words, she always was performing various acts of kindness in terms of a charitable work within the greater Calcutta area. But as for some other more exciting facts about Calcutta, India, here we go. For one, the British East India Company founded Calcutta in the 17th century by establishing it as a fort and trading post. Secondly, Calcutta lies roughly 70 miles inland from the Indian Ocean. Now, there is a river in India. I didn't know about the name of this river until having read the book. I don't expect many of you probably don't even know about this river, but that's fine. I'm here to tell you all about it. But the river was known as the Hooghly River. That's H-O-O-G-H-L-Y, the Hooghly River. The Hooghly River was no ordinary body of water. It was a very difficult body of water, given that many of ships themselves often had issues navigating the river. Well, we should be reminded that, you know, it's one thing for a ship to be on a body of water, like, say, a river, but it doesn't mean that it's a cakewalk for the ship to make it to its final end destination along the river. You know, rivers have a mind of their own. All rivers have currents. All rivers have different sections where people need to be certified to be on, because not everybody should be on every part of a river. But as for the Hooghly River, this particular body of water had been known to give ships all kinds of problems, most notably issues surrounding navigation. Average navigation time took multiple days, including weeks. So we're talking about, in terms of multiple days, say maybe 3 to 5 days at best, just to make it accurately, to make it through the river accurately without any problems. And if the weather didn't cooperate, we're looking at more than a week's time. As for the brig Tuscany, she would have to be required to pass Saugar Island, S-A-U-G-A-R. I'm going to say it as Saugar Island. Saugar Island was a haven for tigers. So can you imagine if you're on board this brig and you have never heard the sound of a tiger when it's roaring? I can't imagine getting off this vessel and wondering, could I be attacked by an animal I've never even seen before? Not just by an animal, but maybe by a herd of tigers. Yes, so the sound and the roar of tigers would have frightened many of the crew. But if that's not challenging enough or awkward enough, how about Saugar Island being a haven for shoals and sandbanks whose presences made it all more challenging in navigating the river's currents while en route to Calcutta's port? Well, if the shoals and the sandbanks are too shallow and you lose control of where you're navigating, you hit a shoal or a sandbar, your cargo flattens out, your ship is in disarray to where the ship and the cargo are all lost. And here we are shipping a delicate commodity that has never been shipped 16,000 miles across the ocean. Yeah, I don't want to risk this. I mean, I want to make a profit, but I sure as hell don't want to have to pay out a whopping loss. All because the captain of the brig did not safely navigate what were waters that had sandbars that were hidden or shoals. I mean, these things do happen, and not everywhere you go may have a lighthouse in the world either, too. But it's up to you to be able to navigate safely. Because if you don't navigate safely, not only are you endangering yourself, you're endangering the crew and the commodity that's being shipped. Were there any conflicting reports about the overall state of ice cargo itself once Tuscany arrived into Calcutta? Yes, there were some conflicting reports. And this could be considered breaking news too, folks, in terms of conflicting reports. In other words, who's telling the truth and who isn't? Well, the India Gazette confirmed that only 1/3 of the ice had melted, 33%, whereas Calcutta Courier stated only 10% of the ice was lost. Whose side do you believe? Who's telling the truth? Who's reporting the right facts? Kind of the same dilemmas that we are dealing with in today's world in terms of the media, but however, in the 19th century, if you live in an area where there's only two newspapers, that can be a bit of a challenge in terms of who is telling the truth. But when you live in a world like today's world, where just about anybody can get access to news, and you've got beyond a dozen news outlets to rely upon, yeah, you'll never really know who's telling the truth. But of course, as the late U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan from New York said, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but everyone's not entitled to their own facts. So let's just be reminded of the fact that, you know, we can all be entitled to our own opinion, but we just can't be entitled to our own facts. In other words, it's up to us to get the facts straight. The India Gazette advocated that ICE itself should be declared free of duty. And I'll mention what the term duty is. Of course, when we think of duties, we think of assignments and tasks. But duty itself has another meaning. But the India Gazette is strongly in favor of declaring the ICE itself to be free of duty, especially once it gets into the port of Calcutta. How so? Because they believe that the reporters of the India Gazette believe that the ICE itself needs to be unloaded immediately. And the British officials agree. They agree that the ICE itself ought to be declared free of duty. In other words, it should be the ICE should be exempt from any kind of levy payments, being that of duties. So, September 13th, 1833, the unloading of ICE from Brig Tuscany officially began. There are no actual records existing that would confirm how much ICE was lost. But Frederick Tudor stated that Tuscany lost one-third of the ICE cargo while en route to Calcutta. A day later, September 14th, reporters from India Gazette visited Tuscany and got to see for themselves all the behind-the-scenes stuff. September 17th, the Calcutta Courier published an advertisement encouraging Calcutta's people to participate in purchasing ICE, including the number of days that the ICE itself would last, along with what not to place next to the ICE or near the ICE. So the paper, the Calcutta Courier, basically said that when you purchase the ICE, it's probably not going to last no more than 60 days. So once you purchase it, you really are looking at best 8 weeks before it completely melts. And if there's one item you are not to place next to the ICE, it is salt. What happens when you put ICE and salt together? The salt can... if it gets on the ice, it starts to dissolve the ice to where there is eventually no ice. Had Frederick Tudor's ice venture business become the talk around Calcutta? Yes. Most notably the British community. We have to remember during this time, folks, India is ruled by Britain. It's part of the great British Empire. Britain, as we know, established Calcutta back in the 17th century. So if Britain established Calcutta during the 17th century, that's also the same time when Britain was establishing its colonial empire in North America. So Britain is no stranger to having a presence known in many countries throughout the world. Not just during this time, but even up into the 20th century, there were a handful of Caribbean nations that were still under British rule up until, say, the late 50s, 1960s, and same for some African nations. I want to say Angola in Africa gained its independence from Britain in 1975. So it just goes to show you that there are still a handful of African and Caribbean nations that have been free, but they're... independence did not have to involve going to war like what the 13 colonies ended up doing with Britain. But the question here is, had Frederick Tudor's ice venture business become all the talk around Calcutta? Yes, the British community firmly believed that the continuation of the ice trade onto itself would greatly benefit people's lives on a daily basis. And because of the success that Frederick, because of the success of this inaugural ice shipment had, a committee was soon formed shortly after the first shipment got made, where advance payments began with the focus on building an ice house. British folk in Calcutta were very big on keeping cool, given that houses sometimes got built with underground sitting rooms, as well as having raised terraces where they could have have exposure to cooler breezes. So we do have to be reminded, folks, that people did find ways to modify their circumstances, even when the weather conditions were not pleasant outside. And of course, it probably might be fair to say that those from within the British community are probably from the well-to-do ranks of society. So they're going to have more means of being able to modify their circumstances, whereas those from the lower tiers of society aren't going to be so fortunate. But what many from the lower tiers of society will have some access to, and it's already now being seen, is that of ice. So it is a good start in the right direction. Now, prior to the arrival of American ice in India, what had the British done beforehand with regards to preserving items such as beverages? They turned to coolants that were available nearby, most notably saltpeter, being a key, which when I think of saltpeter, it's primarily a key ingredient behind making gunpowder, as well as being a popular source for preserving foods. So the British in India would go about taking a mixture of saltpeter and water that resulted in cooling a substance that became submerged into wine and beer, thus allowing these beverages to be consumed like at a dinner table, not just so much at a dinner table, but by the mixture of saltpeter and water onto itself, the cooling substance that ultimately got submerged made these beverages safe to drink. Because it might be fair to say that without the mixture of saltpeter and water, it probably, in terms of in cooling the substance that allowed that became submerged, if that wasn't there, then I don't see how drinking wine and beer would have probably been safe. And I know this might seem a little off the track, but it is something that probably most of you don't know, but I'm here to tell you what the answer is. I didn't know about this until I read a book some time back that was American Revolutionary War related. But there are three ingredients that are essential for making gunpowder. Two of them you could find just about anywhere, and two of the three ingredients were commonly found in the 13 North American colonies under British rule prior to her subjects declaring war, or separation, I should say. But the first two ingredients were charcoal and sulfur, and the last one being saltpeter, a.k.a. potassium nitrate. There was nowhere in the colonies, in the 13 colonies, where saltpeter could be accessible or attained. The only people who had it were England, you know, but England had vast deposits of saltpeter, or I should say potassium nitrate, per the colony of or what was then the colony of India. So that's where they got the bulk of their saltpeter or potassium nitrate, and believe it or not, it's still used today for treating those people battling asthma. It was once administered for helping lower people's blood pressure. Did Frederick himself learn about Tuscany's arrival into Calcutta after January 1st, 1834? Yes, he officially learned about the vessel's arrival while back in Boston come January 31st of 1834. He wanted to send multiple cargoes right away, but Samuel Austin didn't agree to terms. William Rogers stayed put in Calcutta. Here's where things are going to get more interesting in terms of Frederick's perception of things, and in terms of who else is getting credit that he thinks should not be getting any credit. And this is where I see a little bit of selfishness in Frederick. He's a brilliant fella, but even those whom are brilliant can be selfish, and it's not always a good thing. But Here's another question. Did William Rogers get presented with a prestigious gift by British officials in Bengal following Tuscany's successful ice shipment? Yes, he got presented with a silver gilt cup per the highest British authority personnel in Bengal. The silver gilt cup presented to Rogers by Lord William Bentinck, who is a Governor General and Commander-in-Chief of India, and this was presented to William Rogers on November 22nd, 1833. The cup entailed a per-writing inscription, "Enterprise Achievement." Now, come March of 1834, Frederick learned about Rogers' award, and William Rogers never returned to Boston, which might have been a good thing, because had he returned to Boston and had to confront Frederick Tudor, he might have gotten ostracized by Frederick Tudor altogether. He probably would have cut Rogers out of the business altogether. But as for William Rogers, he went about setting up as a boarding house keeper to practicing dentistry part-time in Calcutta. Now, did Frederick, along with Samuel Austin and William Rogers, each make an equal profit per Tuscany's inaugural shipment into Calcutta, India? Yes, each man made a profit of $3,300 on top of ice itself. Get this, folks. The ice itself lasted until December of 1833. So, the ship left out on May 12th of 1833, and it wasn't until September 13th that the ice was unloaded. So if we do the math quickly, that is 124 days. That's almost 18 weeks. To me, that's remarkable in terms of the time that it left Boston to arrive over to Calcutta. But to know that the ice itself lasted until December of 1833 is quite an achievement on itself when you consider the long journey that it took to get from point A to the ultimate end destination of point B, being 16,000 miles across the ocean. In June of 1834, Frederick went about sending a cargo of ice to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's capital. In October of 1834, he learned that it was a successful venture and that he made a $1,000 profit per this load. That might not be the grandest amount, but it sure is better than nothing. I'll take a $1,000 profit any day over no profit whatsoever. Now, what is interesting to point out involving Frederick come December of 1834? This is where things are going to get really, there's going to be some good, and then there's going to be some not so good. I think then what ends up being not so good is going to outweigh the good. But for starters, he began fitting out a vessel or a ship known as the Apthorpe, A-P-T-H-O-R-P, to take ice into Calcutta. Secondly, Frederick decided to send a lengthy letter with the ice load to Lord Bentinck, stating that he himself was entirely responsible for Tuscany's inaugural ice shipment into Calcutta. So basically, he kind of wants to rob William Rogers, given that he was the agent who was willing to make a sacrifice by going over to India. You know, I personally believed William Rogers deserved some credit. But he wants to make it clear that it's not William Rogers' personal endeavor. It is my personal endeavor. I don't mind having people work for me, but it's all about me. I'm the one that has gotten this thing established from the get-go up until this present moment. And it will stay that way. But it's me that needs to be recognized. Other people can be recognized, but it's me that needs to have the bulk of it. So it's fair to say that Frederick is becoming one of those individuals who is an I, me, myself kind of person. And he's going to go to extreme lengths by including a letter to this high-level official in India stating that it was he himself who was entirely responsible for Tuscany's inaugural ice shipment into Calcutta. The letter also mentioned a falling out with Samuel Austin, along with William Rogers, whom Frederick claimed knew nothing about the industry. Talk about stabbing someone in the back. I mean, it's never good to stab someone in the back, but the fact that Samuel Austin and William Rogers were willing to lend a hand and wanting to help Frederick out. You know, this is where you don't burn bridges, people. Yes, they all got their fair share of profit, but just because you get a fair share of profit, that doesn't mean everybody is on equal terms. So the letter mentioned that per the next shipment that would be going out to Calcutta, the letter included a new agent that would be replacing William Rogers. His name was Marcus Bacon, whom worked at Frederick's family's Nahant estate. Bacon got a 30-page manual on how to conduct the ice trade. Can't imagine being in his shoes and getting a 30-page manual on how you are to conduct the ice trade when you are to be going on this next endeavor, or I don't know if I say endeavor, this next ice shipment venture all the way from Boston Bay to Calcutta, India. And on December 19th of 1834, Apthorpe departed Boston Bay. Okay, besides 150 tons, which is the equivalent of 300,000 pounds, so besides 150 tons of ice, aka 300,000 pounds worth of ice, which shipped out on Apthorpe come December 19th of 1834, what else got placed on board the vessel? 359 barrels of Baldwin apples, including boxes of other fruits to packs of butter and cheese. Why is all that important? Well, it's important because Frederick himself is in the middle of conducting experiments with these food items per one of his own ice houses to see how well they stayed preserved over a long period of time. He wants to see if he can replicate this same feat by sending 359 barrels of Baldwin apples, including the boxes of other fruits, to packs of butter and cheese, 16,000 miles across the ocean. He wants to see if he can duplicate, or I should say replicate, the same kind of success. Let's find out if it does happen. August of 1835, Frederick learned that the Apthorpe had not arrived into Calcutta and was still out at sea. The vessel endured major damage to its wheel while navigating the Cape of Good Hope. October 1st, Frederick opened up fruit samples, including butter and cheese, from the ice house at Fresh Pond to discover just how well preserved they remained over a 9-month period. Well, that's great. That's very exciting news. I mean, I would be very thrilled to know that, hey, that butter, cheese, various fruit samples and have all stayed well preserved over a 9-month period. Well, I hate to say this, that bit of good news is not going to last very long, because just a few days after October 1st, Frederick received a letter from agent Marcus Bacon describing the ill-fated story of Apthorpe. Apthorpe arrived into Calcutta after a 163-day voyage, folks. 163 days. All right, there's 7 days in a week. We do the math. That is just shy of 24 weeks. So really about 23 and a half weeks out on the water. We started out with 150 tons of ice, 300,000 pounds of it, folks. Only 2 tons of ice were left intact come the start of June 1834. All fruit and dairy items were ruined. So all the 359 barrels of Baldwin apples, folks, that's all gone down the drain, as well as the boxes of other fruit to the packs of butter and cheese. It's all a total loss. Instead of a surplus, or a positive gain. It's, you know, a deficit, a whopping loss. You know, there's 2,000 pounds or in a ton. He's only got 4,000 pounds of ice are still intact, a.k.a. the 2 tons. June 6th of 1834, the newspaper Bengal Hurkaru reported the hysteria behind the shortage of ice, which had not melted. People are probably in line demanding to get their fair share of what's left of the ice before it's all gone. You would think it's like they're like the equivalent of a gas crisis where people are in line just to fill up with gas. So yes, there is reports of hysteria behind a shortage of ice which had not melted. Frederick's letter to Lord Bentinck was printed in the same issue, and his letter, even in the midst of this crisis, folks, has gained enough support to where he was ultimately recognized for his achievements, most notably being the lead guru behind getting ice trade started. Yeah, this is where you can get caught up in the moment and say, well, oh, it's about me. I did this. I did that. Well, did it ever occur to you that you had that your agents, whom actually worked like Turks, did their part? Yes. Shouldn't they deserve to have some spotlight? Yes. But not everybody thinks that way. But yes, Frederick did get recognized for his achievements, most notably being the lead guru. I can't imagine William Rogers. I can't imagine what he must have been thinking to himself when he learned about this. I mean, yes, he knew that Frederick was the lead guru, but just thinking to himself, well, you know, yes, you are the lead guru. Yes, you have been orchestrating all of this since it first began, but, you know, can't you sit back and let others relish in the spotlight who are helping you? Yeah, it's easier said than done. Well, Frederick's letter proved worthy enough to have British citizens in Calcutta agree to give him a monopoly and raise money for advance payments to build an ice house. Yes, it does pay to have connections, especially with those high and above, but it can come at a price. But at the same time, Frederick he's on a roll, he's on a mission, and wherever he goes to ship ice for the first time, what is he seeking? He's not only seeking a good investment, not only is he seeking a good end result in terms of how much money he will make profit-wise, he wants a monopoly. Because without a monopoly, it's going to lead to bigger competition. It's also going to mean having to invest in advance payments rather than just go all out and say, hey, I want a monopoly. Well, that wraps it up for this podcast segment episode. When I'm on the air again next, we're going to learn about a chapter that's called The Ice Wagon Rolls On. So in other words, the ice industry is still going to be thriving. We'll probably learn about other places that he might consider shipping ice to. We could be learning about other figures whom are going to come in and want to be a part of the business. So those are just some of the many things that we will be learning about when I'm on the air again next time. But wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe. And thank you for being such ardent listeners. Without you guys, I don't know where I would be in terms of podcasting. But you all have made this possible. Thank you again.